Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Millions of people already have cast their votes. Millions more will today. And for most voters, that involves technology. The paper ballot's havoc of the 2000 election brought on the wave of computerized voting machines, but they have their own problems. Joining me is Assistant Director of the University of Maryland Baltimore County Center for Cybersecurity, Dr. Richard Forno. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Is it over yet?
Yeah, no kidding. let me see what it's like, a six, seven, about 8.5 more hours here.
Right.
How vulnerable is computer-based voting in general? Because we keep hearing about rigged elections, which some people translate as into hacking and hacked elections. Are we safe?
Well, I don't think that we're going to see foreign-based hackers, you know, in their, you know, basements or bedrooms doing anything to rig the election, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hack a voting machine from the other side of the world. It doesn't work that way. The very nature of how the U.S. does voting, it really depends on a state-by-state basis. Some states use paper ballots. Some use electronic systems. Some use electronic systems that have paper receipts to them. So there's this hodgepodge. There's no one system for the United States that can be targeted. So in that case, it makes it more difficult for a bad guy to cause mischief, however that mischief may appear. So I think we're not going to see a cybersecurity-related event around this election, I hope.
Can you talk about the typical process of how electronic voting works?
Sure. You have your polling places have a voting machine, a touchscreen machine, let's say, or a scanning machine where they'll scan the ballots. That information then is broadcast across the room, let's say, to the election judge where the votes are tabulated on a precinct-by-precinct basis. That voting data then, probably at the end of the day, is then reported to the county or the state election officials for official tabulation and counting. So all along the way, you know, computers are involved and data is being exchanged. So we need to make sure that the data from the polling place is secure from the polling place all the way up to the Secretary of State when they report the results later tonight.
Hypothetically, could someone hack the Secretary of State's office and the numbers they get?
Hypothetically, yes, that's possible. Hypothetically, a person or a group could hack voter registration systems to create false voters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of my biggest concerns would be showing up at 5 a.m. at a polling place, the first person online to vote, and the judge telling me, you've already voted. That would be very disturbing to me, and that would rock my trust in the system. Fortunately, fingers crossed, we haven't seen that yet.
Uh-huh. And you have referred to the kinds of problems that could be intentionally caused by bad actors. Those would largely be inside jobs, though, right? Someone on the inside and on a poll, you know, precinct basis.
Even there, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
Because people who are running, volunteering at polling places, they're not necessarily hackers or cybersecurity people. They're volunteers from all walks of life. So that would require a little more planning and coordination to get an insider in a position to do something. Again, not impossible, but highly improbable. Where you would see an insider could be in the vendors that create the voting machines. If you can find a way to modify the hardware of the electronic voting device that people use before it leaves the factory, that's a big problem. And that falls into the realm of supply chain security, and that affects all kinds of things, not just voting systems.
So what kind of security is there along the supply chain?
Well, it depends on a vendor. There are many vendors that create and support the electronic voting systems. So we're reliant on them to ensure that their suppliers take proper security practices to prevent tampering with the chips and the software before it even gets put into these systems, which is before they leave the factory to be shipped around the country. So it really comes down to good corporate and cybersecurity practices by the individual voting machine vendors.
Are you confident that that is the case, that that's an issue for the vendors?
I think the vendors are doing a decent job. We've seen reports by companies and researchers far more technically knowledgeable than I am about this that have shown that you can indeed hack into a digital voting machine. But that's done in a laboratory environment under controlled situations and doesn't represent a vulnerability that somebody from overseas could log in and hack into a machine. So what we're seeing is evidence that the voting machines, the digital machines, are vulnerable in some cases. They need to be updated and patched just like you would a home computer to make sure that they're more resilient to any type of security concerns that may be discovered.
I don't know if it was you that I talked to when we talked about maintenance and updating and how some in the past and how some polling or some boards of elections are not prepared to pay for that. They hadn't figured that into their budget back in 2004 when they bought their first, put their first computerized system in place.
That's true. They have not, in many cases, paid the money to update and keep these systems current. So in many cases, these machines are running software that's 10 years old. Well, if you were running a home computer that had 10-year-old software on it, you should be a little concerned.
Yeah, it just it surprised me that that wasn't sort of top of mind kind of an issue. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about cybersecurity when it comes to the voting booth. My guest is Dr. Richard Forno. He's Assistant Director of the University of Maryland Baltimore County Center for Cybersecurity. Questions, comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How do cybersecurity researchers study voting machines and look for flaws? How does that work?
Well, we would approach it just as we would approach looking at any system or device or technology as a hacker would. So we would acquire, we would buy the software or get the vendor to lend us a couple of models to play with. We would bring it into the lab and we would analyze it, whether it's on a network or a wireless environment. We would connect it to various sensors to try to see, are there possible ways we could get into the machine to cause mischief? Again, in a very controlled situation, we would essentially try to hack the machine.
And to be scientific, you'd have to have a control and you'd have to have an experiment.
In some cases, yes. That in a scientific model, you would have a control control version and then the version you're working on. In a lot of cases, though, it's really a matter of can we get in? And if we can get in and demonstrate that there's a vulnerability or a problem, that's good enough to publish and report on. And that's how a lot of cybersecurity research takes place. We don't necessarily have a control element and a test element. We just go right into testing and then reporting what we find.
How do you tell if hacking's occurred? Let's say you're an expert. How would you tell? And then tell me if there's a way for an ordinary person or an ordinary poll worker to tell.
Well, on the inside, first off, the best way to ensure that you to tell whether hacking has or has not occurred or some kind of cybersecurity mischief is to ensure that there's a paper trail of everybody's vote data so that if there are questions raised, there are more voters voting in a district than there are residents in the district, that might raise some red flags. We can go back to the paper trail and manually count votes and see where the discrepancies lie. So having a paper trail that is, what we call has integrity, it's not been tampered with, is a very good way to see if voter fraud took place in the digital realm. The end users, the individual voters, if they have a paper receipt that they take home with them from after casting their vote, they can use that. If there were questions raised, the local polling officials might say, if you voted in this precinct, please bring your receipts back so we can cross-verify what you voted versus what we recorded. So that's just a couple of basic ways how you could try to investigate
now,
allegations.
In Ohio, they don't get paper receipts. That's against the law in Ohio because of threats of corruption, bribery, that kind of a thing. To any kind of taking selfies in a voting booth to show how you voted is against the law. But there is a paper receipt printed on the machine that you can look at after you vote. And sometimes I wonder how many people actually look at that and double check that their vote was recorded correctly.
I Yeah, that, again, people are happy to cast their vote. They may or may not look for that. But again, even there, there's a paper receipt that is generated and it's stored somewhere. So you have to have confidence that that paper receipt will be useful if called upon as evidence, if you will.
Right. You've written about internet-based tools to generate influence within a target group, and that sounds just like advertising to me. Is that what you're talking about, or what do you mean by that?
Yes, I think a lot of what we're seeing in 2016 around the rigged election and foreign hackers, yes, there have been cybersecurity issues with the election, with the DNC hack and things like that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the election, as most elections, but this one in particular, has been a battle for the mind. And if you can drive home key phrases like a rigged election, things like that, or labels of people, what that does is create this warped sense of reality. And it is really marketing when you come down to it. You have candidates and campaigns trying to, you know, pass along a message to market a certain way to get people to vote in a certain way. So, yeah, it is really advertising when you get down to it.
Right. You list trust as a vulnerability at the ballot box, that we have to trust the technology works.
Right. And in this election, what really disturbed me and still does even today is if we can't trust the system and the process, the technology and the process and procedures that we citizens use to determine the fate of our country, that strikes at the very heart of what it is to be an American and at the very heart of democracy. That scares me. And I think this really was driven home in the past few months in this campaign. So hopefully we'll learn from this and won't repeat it in 2020.
Do you think that is there any sense that we ought to go back to the paper ballots, you know, the hanging Chad scenarios of 2000, that the computerization, largely computerization of voting in the United States has been a success or what?
I think we're in the early stages of electronic voting. I mean, we're 10 years into it or so, but it's still fairly early in the mm-hmm. grand scheme. So maybe 30 years from now, we won't have these problems because the kinks will be worked out. But in the meantime, I don't think going back to paper balloting is a bad idea. We just need to make sure we design the ballots that they're easily understood and they don't create the hanging chads.
You don't think there was anything particularly wrong with it? We have an email from Joe. We've covered this before many times, but I just want to, if we're still getting questions about it, it's so important. He asks, are electronic polling devices connected to the internet or any sort of internet? Or any sort of network?
The short answer to that is probably not, but I won't say 100% no. Mm-hmm. In most cases, the only network connection would be from the individual digital voting machine in the booth to the computer maybe across the room in the gymnasium that counts all the data and administers that local network. But that network is self-contained, so you're not going to have somebody, you know, in California logging into a machine in Ohio. It doesn't work that way. So I have relatively strong confidence that these polling place networks are self-contained.
And then I wanted to go back again, you know, that as the first generation of voting machines age, maintenance and updating become an issue. And what is your sense about how well-funded, you know, the people who run the voting systems in the United States are to do that and to continue doing that on an ongoing basis? It's not cheap.
It's not cheap, and that's something that the states have to decide, you know, is this a high priority for them? And if so, they need to budget accordingly. Like every other budget item, there are trade-offs. And state by state, they need to realize and recognize if this is a huge problem for us and our people, well, we've got to devote the resources to fix it, just like our infrastructure. This is our voting infrastructure. Are we going to fix it or are we going to let it crumble?
Well, Richard Forno, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time as always.
My pleasure.
Dr. Richard Forno is the assistant director of the University of Maryland Baltimore County Center for Cybersecurity. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Science fiction often revolves around dystopian societies and often places where technology plays a negative role. With drones overhead, self-driving cars on the road, and smartphones at our fingertips, such imaginings don't seem far off. A new collection of short stories by Alexander Weinstein, Children of the New World, is set in a near future world that references familiar technologies from today. Alexander Weinstein joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
What triggered your interest in the future of technology?
Well, the first story in the collection, Saying Goodbye to Yang, that was the beginning of that whole collection, where what happened was my laptop broke down and it took a lot of my creative work with it. And I had this deep emotional reaction to this piece of equipment breaking down. And around the same time, my students were getting iPhones and smartphones, and they were all saying, boy, you know, I just love my phone. God forbid I ever lose my smartphone. You know, I think they would have traded a distant family member for their phones. And so I started realizing, well, this is, we're having these emotional connections with technology at this point. And then in the last 10 years, over the duration of which I was writing this collection, it's just gotten stranger and stranger as far as our emotional connections online.
You know, in Saying Goodbye to Yang, and that was the first story in the collection, and a lot of the stories in the collection resonated with me in this way, that it was a lot more about what makes us human. As technology defines us, it also sort of puts us in relief and shows in relief what's left over, what's human about us.
Yeah, very much so. That's a big concern or, you know, interest for me, is this humanity. And in many ways, I think of the stories as realist stories, just 10 years in the future,
yeah,
or 20 years in the future, because I'm looking a lot at, you know, how to be good parents, how to be good lovers, how to be good human beings and neighbors, and really how technology intrudes in many ways in our ability to be more intimate with others, have personable relationships, these kind of things. And that's, for me, the heart of all the stories and the characters, is that they are human, that they are struggling, they're trying to be better in some way, usually.
In Yang, there was just a few little details, but suggested that he had some human qualities as well, even though he was a robot.
Yeah, that's the fun part about that story, right? That he has this bug collection, which he thinks is very beautiful, and he's definitely not programmed to go collect bugs. Or his art project that he's making with matchsticks that is completely off the grid of his programming. And so that, for me, as the author, I mean, I'm very attached to Yang, and I feel like Yang has a soul, but I may be as duped just by some glitchiness in his programming.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the questions, or the unanswered questions, is of that story, is, was Yang a boy? Did he have a, you know, did he transcend his AI programming?
Yeah.
I don't have the answer. I don't have the answer to that necessarily, even though I wrote it. So I kind of like that, you know, weirdness that puts us in.
I don't think there was one of the stories that I read, and I read them all, that didn't make me want to know more about that larger world, because they were very encapsulated stories, really. They weren't broad, sweeping looks at the larger world.
Yeah, and that's, you know, in many ways, that's how the stories link together, that they provide different parts of that world, right? So you get a glimpse here of a certain technology or suburb district. And there, of course, they're set at different times. Like in migration, you have a world where everybody stays inside. And so the external world has grown into this sort of wilderness of animals on their migration and what have you. That's a different, very different landscape than, let's say, Ice Age, where there's a second Ice Age and everything's complete ice. But I feel like in many ways they're related. Ice Age is just happening much later than migration in that way. And so these are snapshots of the different communities that exist in this world that I've created.
You know, we talk about tchotchkes and things, you know, the grandma's tchotchkes and who's going to get stuck with those or who gets
right.
rid of them and that kind of a thing. And I know people who have boxes and boxes of old cell phones that they just can't get rid of.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll probably have more and more of that. Right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, I kind of make that critique or make that joke in the story Openness, where they go and visit the father, and lo and behold, he has an iPad, which is very outdated at that point, but that's where all the family photos are on. And that's not that distant in many ways. While it's a joke that, you know, God forbid he loses his tablet because there goes all the family photos, I think that's the case for many of us. I was asking recently at a reading how many people still print out photos and put them in albums. And I would say it was less than 10% of the audience. So I think a lot of us put all these, you know, these tchotchkes that hold now all our personal data. Many people don't remember cell phones, myself included. I mean, the telephone numbers of friends and family because of the cell phone, right?
Right. And I can still remember my phone number from when I was very young, but I couldn't tell you what the phone number was for the last phone I had.
I know. It's so interesting because it's like anything that happened before smartphones, we can remember. It's just locked in there. I can remember my childhood phone number and best friend's phone number from back then.
Uh-huh.
But after that, it disappears. I find the same thing happens with GPS, where if you're just following GPS, I can make the same trip 20 times, and without the GPS, I cannot find my way there. If I have to take one time where I really learn the directions, then it's memorized.
Well, that's just like me. If I'm just a passenger in a car, never ask me to get you back where we were because
right.
I was not paying attention. I might have been on my phone playing Words with Friends or something.
Right, exactly.
Ironically, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what the future might hold when it comes to technology. My guest is Alexander Weinstein. He's the author of a short story collection entitled Children of the New World. If you have a question or comment for Alexander, give us a call. What do you think the future holds as far as technology? Do you have any ideas for him as a writer? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So do you consider yourself a science fiction author, Alexander?
I don't really. I mean, I dip into sci-fi, but I tend to call it more speculative fiction in that genre only because, you know, I feel like a badge of honor for sci-fi writers is that it's scientifically researched and provable, and a lot of times it works with that. And these stories don't do that, right? They're just sort of speculating on the technology, but there's no real explanation or scientific backing to that. And so in that way, it has one foot in sci-fi, I think, and one foot in literary realism. And so genres like slipstream or speculative fiction seem to cover it.
There's a lot of reference to implants, computer implants,
yeah.
How we start to merge computers and the digital world with our real world.
Yeah, I think that's where we're heading, unfortunately. I mean, one of the scary things is so many of the predictions I made in the stories, which were intended to be warnings, right? Or like, let's not go there, are already happening. And so, you know, recently somebody sent me an article about temporary tattoos that will be digitally enabled so that we'll have an interface we can wear on us. And that may be a more charming way than implants. We might be more prone to get these temporary tattoos right now since implants have this super sci-fi dystopian feel to them. But I think a lot of people would take them, right, would go for implants. I'm thinking when Google Glass came out, you know, sort of came and went, and they were beta testing it.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into a student that had them, that was wearing them, and I said, "What do you think of them?" He said, "It's great. We're becoming enhanced human beings," with no sense of cynicism or critique, right? He was just very excited that we were going to be able to enhance our capabilities. I think that would be a prime example of somebody who would certainly go in for the implant surgery if it becomes available.
Right. It might not be my generation, but younger generations, digital natives, who don't find it troubling at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's increasing in some ways just by having this conversation, right? There's a kind of where I come off as a fuddy-duddy because I'm saying, well, boy, can you look at how everybody's texting nowadays, you know, something like that. But there really is, among certain people, just a complete acceptance of technology. That said, I think a lot of us are getting very tired of technology, sort of a fatigue of having to constantly update our profiles, check the inbox, get the Netflix thing set up, make sure you have Amazon Prime and somebody sending you a invitation to LinkedIn or whatever it is. It's a little too much these days.
Yeah, I agree. I was just in the airport over the weekend a lot, and that's in places like that where a lot of people are just sitting around. Everybody had their phone out.
Right.
It was weird.
Yeah, and you see it when you visit, or if you live in New York and you ride the subway or waiting for the subway, it really is a kind of zombie look. Everybody mm-hmm. is just staring down at their phones. It's strange that we've gotten to this place. And I think maybe we're at a breaking point where we're all aware of it. I think even as we do it, like I'll walk down the street and I'm checking my phone and I'm thinking, I really shouldn't do this. Maybe I should just walk and enjoy the fall leaves or something. Mm-hmm. So there's this addiction that's happened. We're kind of in the binge drinking phase of the addiction right now, but I think it's going to break. I think we're becoming aware of our addiction, which is the first step to recovery.
There was one of the stories, I cannot remember the title of it, and I apologize for that, but it was the guy who had to go outside to find his kid because his kid just wanted to be outside so badly, but nobody went outside anymore. They didn't have to.
That's
and
right.
That reminded me of, I can't remember, I'm terrible at this, but a Kurt Vonnegut story, too, about how people mm-hmm. just detached from each other.
Yeah, I mean, Vonnegut, I really love. He's one of my inspirations.
Me
for
too.
Sure. What a great writer.
Yeah.
And it is that mix of humanity, dystopia, slight cynicism, but also at the heart, a kind of optimism that's going on there. And that story has that feel, right? I mean, the boy in question who's a teenager, the parents are worried that he wants to go outside to get drugs. And all he wants to do is bicycle, right?
Yeah.
But they just can't understand why would he want a bicycle? This makes no sense because they've become so online addicted.
And they never leave their home.
And they never leave their home. And so in that way, that sort of is a reversal of what we were talking about, where it's really the younger generations that are detaching in that story, right? It's the teenage son who says, I want to go outside, and the parents who weren't born to this technology, but became addicted to it. And in some ways, I think we're seeing that too. As a parent, there are ways that I check my phone sometimes more than my son, right? So it may be the younger generations that'll save the older generations mm-hmm. from this technology.
And then the dangers of becoming detached from the real world, the physicality of it, the imperfections of it.
Yeah, that's, I think about that a good deal because we're so used to now streamlined websites and cyberspaces, which are much more beautiful in some ways than if you look at sometimes the wastelands of our landscapes, depending where you are, but the closed down mini malls and these kind of ghost towns from foreclosed houses and, you know, kind of economic, the way that the economics and political and corporate interests have affected our actual landscapes is slightly depressing, to put it mildly.
It, it all looks the same. I was just in another city, and the strip malls look exactly the same as they do here.
Right. And so then you have this online world, which is much more streamlined, and you can have all your preferences and exactly like you want it. And I do think that gives us a false sense of perfection in many ways, and a bad sense of how to be compassionate and empathetic to things that don't match up with our preferences. That it's, we're getting so used to everything being kind of narcissistically provided for us through technology that figuring out how to deal with somebody that doesn't share your opinion, that's a good skill to learn, for example.
In the story about the dad who had to go ahead, he had to go outside. He didn't want to go outside, but he had to go outside to find his kid because they were worried it was dangerous out there. And he hadn't been out there in so long. He got out there and kind of looked around and went, wow, there's nobody out here.
Yeah.
You know, he's not really in that much danger. But then at the end, they pause and they just kind of stare together out at the scenery. And that made me think that maybe you have a sense of hope for the future.
Yes, for sure. You know, I often say if I wasn't such an optimist, I wouldn't be so cynical. Right? it is, I do have a lot of hope that there will be this, and there, not that there will, there is an, a re-embrace and sort of a hope for the earth and for communities and community development and helping one another, and that exists hand in hand with a lot of the injustices and more dystopian present day things that are going on. And so, you know, I've been looking at the North Dakota pipeline, everything, all the protests that are happening out there, and the unity of the tribes and of people coming forward to say, please protect this earth. That's very inspiring. Of course, the National Guard, you know, being called out and shooting them with rubber bullets is very depressing.
Yeah.
So there is this continual, I think, fight in many ways between optimism and depression in that way when we look at the world. But I try to put in the stories a lot of hope for humanity, that love will save the day, so to speak, that we will never fully give over to technology and corporate interests and all of that, that we want to fight for our families and for our lovers and all of these things.
Well, Alexander Weinstein, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it. I really appreciate it. I love the book.
Oh, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
Alexander Weinstein is the author of a short story collection that looks a little bit into the future and our relationship with technology. The book is entitled Children of the New World. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 6 years ago, the toy-to-life genre was born. The idea is that physical toys could also be playable characters in a video game. The Skylanders series of games is out with a new version called Skylanders Imaginator. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
First of all, can you re-explain to us how these physical toys, these little, they're pretty small, how they work with a video game, how that works?
Sure. So when it comes to a PC or a game console, there's a small, you know, kind of stand that connects via USB cable, and you have all of these figurines that have these little chips in the bottom of their bases. And when you take those figurines off of your shelf and put them on this base, then the you know, disc underneath that chip gets read, and that character and all of the information about how you've played with that character so far gets put into the game for you to then play as that character.
And how big has this gotten?
Every year it gets just a little tiny bit bigger. The Skylanders franchise has really been kind of fascinating. Because there's not been anything else really quite like it that matched it as far as popularity. It's the one thing, you know, every Christmas for the last couple of years, you go into a toy store and there's just a wall of these figurines. And after, you know, Thanksgiving, they're usually very hard to get a hold of.
Because this is what kids want.
Absolutely, yeah. This is the big thing that, you know, kids want. And, you know, over the last year, we saw, you know, Disney try really hard to release a competing set of games where they took all of the incredibly popular, figure characters from all of the Disney universes, including, you know, Marvel and Star Wars.
Yeah.
Try and release a competing product. And they actually canceled it this year. They shut it down, and Skylanders has outlived it because the Disney people just weren't able to compete on the same level.
Why do you think that is?
You know, it's really hard to say. I think that this is just one of those things that the game is simple enough that it can be compelling for any skill level. The ability to collect these figurines has just been, overwhelmingly popular. And that was the thing that Disney was kind of leaning on, was the desire to collect characters that you knew, you know, uh-huh. that you had seen in movies. That ended up not being the big part of it. So I don't think it's any one thing, so much as just, you know, something that's been around long enough to retain that popularity.
So tell us about what sets Skylanders apart, you know, that in that series, what is it about?
Really, it's there's you know a single character who is you know kind of the big evil influence, and has you know done terrible things to kind of divide a group of worlds that are kind of floating in the clouds. And you, you know, with these characters that you pick up along the way, you know, kind of create this stronger force to overtake him at the end.
What does the game cost and adding characters and stuff? It must be sort of affordable once you get the initial layout, right?
Sure. I mean, in most cases, you know, you get the kind of starter kit, which is between $70 and $80, depending on what set you get it for. And that gets you the game and the base station and three figurines. And the figurines afterwards, they range from $7 to $15, depending on how many are in the pack that you purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can start, you know, with what you have in the box, in the very first box. You can play through most of the game with just the three figurines that are included. But in most cases, in order to unlock everything that's in the game and play all of the levels that are in the game, you have to go and buy some of these extra figurines.
Do you envision these types of games gaining in popularity, especially after what we've learned from the, you know, the Disney experience?
I think that what we're seeing here with this most recent release with Imaginators is, you know, kind of taking that step away from, you know, the collectible setup where everything has to have kind of this finite thing. I think we're almost reverting back to the you know more traditional form of gameplay in that Imaginators releases instead of the individual figurines, there are these crystals that you buy that you know sit on top of the stand, and instead of having a single character that is loaded into that crystal, it's actually something that the kid designs themselves.
Huh.
There's an app that goes along with it that gets installed on a phone or on a tablet. And, you know, the child has the ability to create what abilities that character has and what it looks like and you know, how it's, you know, completely designed, and then load that creation onto this crystal so that the character is entirely unique and can be played through the entire game and doesn't have a physical representation because there was no way to anticipate what it was that the kid was going to want.
So you're saying if you want it, you better get it by Thanksgiving because it's that popular.
That's how this has gone every year in the past. You know, the Skylander franchise, you know, especially, you know, in the traditional toy stores, Toys R Us and Best Buy and places like that,
mm-hmm.
There are always huge displays right around Black Friday or, you know, just before. And from that gap between Black Friday and Christmas, these games are traditionally very hard to get a hold of.
Okay. Moving on. When it comes to streaming video, there are lots of options. Amazon, Apple, Roku, Google. Last month, Google announced a new version of its Chromecast. It's called Chromecast Ultra. You've been a fan of Chromecast. How does Ultra work for you?
Well, so the Chromecast Ultra is really kind of designed to appeal to everyone who really likes the idea of a Chromecast but didn't see that it fit their needs. And these are kind of, you know, people who are streaming, you know, to 4K televisions or who have, you know, hardwired setups in their house where they don't want to use a wireless network to stream something. They want to use an Ethernet cable to connect it to. And so those users are who the Chromecast Ultra is built for. This is a 4K streaming setup instead of the traditional 1080p streaming setup, and has an Ethernet connection built into it so that you can, you know, guarantee that you're going to get the best possible video stream from, you know, this little thing that plugs into the back of your television.
You mean best, like, quality video stream?
Right. This
okay.
is something, you know, the focus here is to get the highest possible quality to make sure that there are never instances where, you know, the buffering message shows up or anything like that. This is designed to be the closest thing to, you know, putting a DVD in as far as being able to press the play button and have the video just show up in, you know, perfect quality on the television.
So this is can stream in 4K.
Correct. Yeah, that's the, you know, the big upgrade here is 4K streaming. And that's something that has been, you know, difficult to roll out for a lot of manufacturers for, you know, competing hardware accessories. Apple, for example, doesn't offer a 4K streaming capability yet, because, you know, managing that amount of data, you know, and working with the individual companies that have 4K video to stream, Netflix and YouTube being the two biggest right now, is just, it's a lot of work to make it work without having, you know, video quality loss or stuttering or buffering or anything like that. And so a lot of companies are just kind of waiting a year for 4K, you know, compression to be a little easier to deal with.
So do you need a 4K TV to make buying the Chromecast Ultra worth it?
You are going to get the best experience out of a 4K television. You're going to be able to see the best possible picture. But the you know, if you're still unhappy with, you know, how the existing Chromecast setup streams, if you're looking for something that, you know, will have a higher quality connection and you know, more instant response when you press the play button, then this will get you that.
Okay. And it's also twice the price of the Chromecast. I guess that's where the worth it comes in. Does the speed make up for the price increase or not?
Right. And that's going to be the, you know, kind of the individual use case. For me personally,
yeah,
I don't feel the need to upgrade because the existing Chromecast works on my television just fine, but I also don't have a 4K television.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really is just going to depend on who is using this technology and how they're using it.
This is going to make my spouse wince, but I don't even know if ours is 4K or not. So, you know, he's wincing right now. Okay. The Chromecast Ultra will be compatible with Google Home, the voice-activated speaker with Google Assistant. How does that work?
It's actually kind of neat. They just started rolling that feature out this week, and it started out with just YouTube support. So you can say, you know, okay, Google, you know, play this on my television, and whatever, you know, the search result returns is what it'll play on the television. So if you know the name of the YouTube video that you want to watch, or if you know the name of the channel on YouTube that you want to watch, then you can just speak that request out, and you can say on my television, or give the name that you have assigned to the Chromecast, and it just does it. It's really kind of interesting to see how it works.
So how much does it cost? I said it was double, but I don't even know double of what.
Oh, so they start at $70.
Okay.
The normal Chromecast is $35.
Yeah, which is so affordable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, very competitive when compared to Roku and Apple TV and a lot of these things. It's, you know, something that Google has done really well over the last couple of years is this Chromecast setup.
Kept it very accessible. You recently made your pick for the best Android smartwatch on the market. This is, you know, people are waiting with bated breath. But before we get to your pick, how many different Android smartwatches are out there?
At last count, there are 13.
Holy Toledo.
And that includes a couple of models that have been discontinued, though. So I think that you can buy now, I think, is 8.
Okay. And which is still a lot. Your favorite is the Huawei, spelled Huawei, for those of us who don't know how to pronounce things. Watch, it's from the Chinese tech company Huawei. One reason you like it is because it's round. So it's like you like the traditional look, right?
It looks like a watch on your wrist. And I feel like that weirdly should be a requirement for, you know, something that calls itself a watch and sits on your wrist, is that it actually kind of look and feel and behave like a watch most of the time.
Yeah.
And that's something that I feel like a lot of the companies making smartwatches, Apple included, just kind of ignore, which is kind of fascinating. But you know, it's a personal preference, you know, for me, that the watch kind of look and feel like a watch when it sits on your wrist. And that's something Huawei has done very well, not just in, you know, making the display round and having it, you know, look very much like a traditional watch when it sits on your wrist, but the display is designed to work, you know, both in daylight and in very dark rooms, just very well, you know,
without adjusting
very
it?
Dark without adjusting it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something that, you know, it functions in enough spaces that most of the time it feels like a watch on your wrist. And I felt like that was a really important feature.
What else makes it stand out? You said the lighting adjusts automatically. Anything else?
So the other two things that make this stand out, the battery will get you through more than a day. So you don't need to worry about, you know, the watch dying on your wrist after, you know, 12 hours of wearing it. You can usually wear this for two whole days without needing to charge it. And it has a speaker built into the watch band itself, or I'm sorry, the watch body itself, for if you are one of the people who decides that they want to just go full Dick Tracy and talk into their watch in order to talk into the phone. It's a feature that's available, but there's not a whole lot of people that use it. So it's you know, kind of split between whether that's an entirely useful feature or not.
Well, because in real life, nobody really wants to look like Dick Tracy talking at their wrist.
I didn't think so either. And I actually very recently was talking to someone who uses the feature all the time when he is playing games. Sitting on his couch, if his girlfriend calls him while he is playing on his Xbox, then he can answer the phone and talk without having to stop playing his game. And I couldn't stop laughing.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, someone's thinking about it, I guess. So they must know what they're talking about. How much does it cost and how does it compare to other Android watches in terms of that?
So this is going to start at $300, and that is usually around $50 more than your average Android Wear watch that you're going to see from Motorola or LG in a lot of cases. So this is, you know, it's priced as though it is, you know, a superior product. And in most situations I've found after using all of them, it really is.
Mm-hmm. You also like the Moto 360 smartwatch from Motorola. What's the selling point there?
So the Moto 360 has just this incredible amount of customization that you can really go to personalize. It is not a complete circle for the display, despite being called the 360. There's a little notch at the bottom for some extra sensors for motion sensing and things like that. The battery on it is very good, but really the customization is a huge part of what makes this special. You can design, you know, the texture of the metal that goes around the band, the color of the band. There's a lot of flexibility there, and that's something that I found really interesting.
Is by any chance is a Moto 360 gonna work better with your Moto X phone?
No, the Android Wear is you know, kind of a single platform that's designed to work, you know, very much the same way on all Android phones.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so people who like to have all their appliances from the same company in the kitchen, that's not necessary when it comes to this kind of stuff, unless it's Apple.
No, not in this situation.
Yeah. T-Mobile and Alcatel are releasing a new smartphone with Windows 10 Mobile. Tell us what's going on with that.
So this is interesting for three reasons. One, Windows Mobile isn't dead. there are still companies making, you know, Windows Mobile. They're supporting Windows Mobile apps, and that's important for Microsoft to continue to push this kind of one ecosystem thing, where developers can build a single app for Windows and have it work the same way on your Windows PC, your Xbox, and your smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's something that Windows has done very well over the last year in encouraging developers to release these apps to work that way. But there's just not been a whole lot of hardware to demonstrate it and have it, you know, really be useful. And this is an inexpensive Windows phone that also comes with, like in the box, it's built into the phone itself, actually, is a VR headset.
What do you make of that? I mean,
I thought this was a really clever touch, you know, for Alcatel, because the VR headset, when you go to buy this phone in the store, It's the box that holds the phone, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, I get you.
It's a plastic box that they hand you.
Yeah.
And so it was really kind of clever design on their part, but it also adds this kind of extra feature for someone who buys the phone, you know, because it's a passive, you know, virtual reality experience. You can watch 360-degree videos in VR, and there aren't a ton of games available yet on this particular marketplace, but there are, you know, it's a big step forward for anyone interested in, you know, kind of exploring that 360 video experience.
Well, we're out of time, Russell Holly. Thanks for talking with us. I appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Russell Holly. He is contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Don't forget to vote. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.